This is Healthy Rounds with Dr. Anthony Alessi, sponsored by St. Francis Hospital, Ratchford Eye Center, Hartford Healthcare, MD Advantage, and UConn Health Orthopedic and Sports Medicine. Healthy Rounds provides general information regarding medical conditions and diseases. The information is not intended to create a doctor-patient relationship. You are encouraged to consult your own medical provider for advice that applies to your own medical care. And now, Dr. Anthony Alessi on WTIC, News Talk 1080 and WTIC.com.
Welcome to Healthy Rounds, a show that provides you with up-to-date medical information, and we answer all of your health questions. I'm your host, Dr. Anthony Alessi, and it's great to be with you for this next hour here on the radio and this Saturday, and we're in the midst of Super Bowl weekend for many of you planning that. Also, we continue to struggle with the COVID-19 pandemic. Our Connecticut positivity is holding steady at 8%, similar to what it was last week. We're seeing fewer and fewer masks, and I think we're seeing more and more upper respiratory problems that are unrelated to COVID. So, again, I ask people to bear in mind that if you're not feeling well or if you're going to be in close surroundings, take out a mask. No one's going to think less of you for it. It's unfortunate that with the precautions we've been taking that people now, again, see them as a political statement. And it's somewhat irritating. A perfect example is I perform procedures on patients. And I'll have to be in a room sometimes with the patient unmasked for an hour or more. So if a patient is not vaccinated, I ask that they get tested within 48 hours of doing the procedure, similar to what most people require for procedures or even minor surgeries. But I just had one instance this week where the patient told my assistant, I guess he's one of those guys. I don't know what one of those guys is, but if one of those guys is a person who wants to protect his staff and the people around him and to help patients, I guess I am. So we really need to keep in mind that we have to use these precautions in a medical setting, even at this time. And again, I do try to encourage people to get vaccinated. This month is Heart Health Month. And I'm going to have my guest this week is going to be Dr. Ofer Sagiv. Ofer is a cardiologist. He is with St. Francis Hospital. And what we're starting to see is more of a community-based practice. So he is with the Hoffman Heart Institute. And they have, they're again, moving away from main campuses, which is the way to do it, right? Where parking is more convenient, easier access to the community. So we're going to talk to him about heart conditions. In the past week, I've gotten questions from many of you since we announced it in advance. So we're going to bring him on actually earlier than just doing the bottom of the hour so we can get a lot of information and questions answered from Dr. Sagiv. February 11th, 1937, Dr. Adolf Fick died. Now, Dr. Fick is not to be confused with his uncle, as I found out. This Dr. Fick is Adolf Gaston Eugene Fick, and he was an ophthalmologist who in 1888 constructed and fitted what is believed to be the first contact lens. So contact lenses have been around for a very long time. And they have clearly evolved. Who would ever think that we'd reach the time where we have disposable contact lenses? His uncle, Dr. Adolf Eugene Fick, was the person who first discovered he was a cardiologist, and he really came up with the measurements for cardiac output, which is something we're going to be talking with Dr. Sagiv about, because one of our questions comes up. With that, it's also the feast today of Saint Bernadette of Saubert. So Bernadette was the young woman who had the apparition of the Virgin at Lourdes, and she was a nurse in the Franco-Prussian War. But Lourdes is a place where people of deep faith go with the hope of having illness cured. So that has been a place in France that attracts many, many pilgrims. This week, we had the State of the Union address. And a lot has been spoken about since the State of the Union address about Medicare. Who wants to end Medicare, who wants to continue Medicare. And I'm not going to get into the politics of it at all. But what I will make clear is that I resent the fact that many journalists refer to Medicare as an entitlement program. It's not. And they use Medicaid and Medicare with the same terms. Medicaid is an entitlement program. It's for people who are unable to pay medical expenses, kind of down on their luck. It was designed so that people will get medical care even though they can't afford it. It's an entitlement program paid for out of our taxes. Medicare is an insurance program, much like Social Security, and they go hand in hand. You actually pay for Medicare out of your paycheck every 2 weeks, the same as you pay for Social Security. So the fact that you're paying for it makes it not an entitlement program. And I think most of our listeners today who may be getting Medicare will certainly, or even younger people who look at their paycheck and their pay stub, realize that they are paying for this program. So when you hear journalists either writing about it or speaking about Medicare, it is clearly not an entitlement program and should not be lumped the same with Medicaid, which is a state program. What's also interesting is we've had these discussions on Medicare before with Dr. Carden, who was on from Hartford Healthcare. And we talked about the Care Partners, which is a Medicare Advantage plan. And Medicare Advantage plans are kind of one-stop shopping where you get a lot of different benefits in terms of some dental, prescription, things such as that, as opposed to buying, getting regular Medicare and then buying a supplement to cover those things. Interesting thing I found out was that in 2022, 48% of Medicare beneficiaries actually chose an Advantage plan over the original Medicare. Now, Advantage plans are administered by outside companies. They are not administered by the government. So inherently, they are much more efficient. But again, you have a limited network in an Advantage plan. And in many cases, need pre-approval before you get things, as opposed to people who buy Medicare and Medigap insurance, which you pay for. It's often said with the alternative and the Advantage programs, they're really designed for people who are healthy in many respects because you don't have to buy the additional coverage, and you get all these other things. So the basics of it are, if you're healthy, I think that really becomes a big thing in terms of going into an Advantage program. And most of the people who choose Advantage plans really know someone else who got it. They're talking to a neighbor, said, hey, yeah, you know, I signed up for this plan, Care Partners, and it's worked out great for me. So, again, I'm surprised, but yeah, it's a growing population of people going into Medicare Advantage. This week, we also saw just kind of a follow-up to the previous story on Damar Hamlin. We talked about Mr. Hamlin and playing football and the fact that he had sudden cardiac arrest on the field and the importance of AEDs, automated external defibrillators, right? So, and using these AEDs and the importance of them. What I didn't realize is the numbers. You know, we hear anecdotally, we see on TV young athlete, a teenager playing a sport, or a little leaguer playing a sport and suddenly collapses, whether it be from commotio cordis, from getting struck over the heart, or just having sudden cardiac collapse. In a recent interview with Dr. Doug Casa over here at UConn, he really cited, I was surprised, the statistics are there are about 100 athletes every year who have sudden cardiac arrest. Most of these are young athletes. So just think, that's one every 3 to 4 days. So again, we need to push for having these AEDs at all sporting events, not just the high-level sports, not just the UConn games. You need them at every event. They're not very expensive. They're about $1,000. And I think that, obviously, if you can save 100 lives a year in this country, that's a big thing. That's a big deal. So when you go to your local Board of Ed and you're having your league meetings, or, you know, we're getting ready now for Little League season, right? So everybody's getting together. Coaches are going to get together. There are going to be some rule changes. Somebody should raise their hand and just say, will there be an AED available at our games? And many times there are multiple games going on multiple fields, so you really only need one AED, but everybody needs to know where it is. So you might have 3 or 4 games going on a huge field like we have here in Connecticut, and you're able to do it that way. We're going to take a short break. Now we're going to be back with my guest, Dr. Ofer Sagiv. He is a cardiologist at St. Francis Hospital. He is with the Hoffman Heart and Vascular Institute. And we're going to be chatting a lot about cardiac disease in honor of Heart Health Month. You're listening to Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080. We're back on Healthy Rounds. I'm your host, Dr. Anthony Alessi. And if you have questions for me, either live on the air or during the week, you can reach me at info@alessimd.com, as many of you have. And I want to welcome my guest today, Dr. Ofer Sagiv. Dr. Sagiv is a cardiologist specializing a lot in echocardiography and cardiac imaging. He is part of Trinity Health of New England, and as we know it as St. Francis Hospital. But specifically, he works at the Hoffman Health and Vascular Institute. And they've opened a new location at the Shops at Farmington Valley in Canton. So very interesting to bring advanced cardiac technology to the community. Ofer, welcome to the show.
Nice to talk to you. And Tony, how are you?
All right. So let's start. Actually, before we get into the nitty-gritty of cardiac disease, let's talk about the new institute. What could you tell us about it, and what prompted this move off the main campus to go to really one of the more popular shopping areas in our region?
Well, you know, the problem is, as you know, Hartford is a city. It's hard to get to. At least my patients, I've worked many years in the northwest part of Connecticut, and it's really difficult for them, especially the elderly, to get to Hartford. So, you know, we opening this practice here not only brings general cardiology, but the plan in the works, and actually as we are developing this, is to get some of the subspecialties in cardiology into the community. That's really going to help get the specialist into the community, so patients don't have to travel so far away. That deters people actually from getting specialized care. This would actually help the community getting the care next to where they live.
Well, actually, I find the advantage to be the fact that you could park close to the front door. And if you have cardiac disease, that makes a big difference. So
that's right.
we're getting down to the basics. But let's get into it. Actually, you talked about some of the new technologies. Let's jump in with calcium score. I had one of these done. My primary care physician recommended it. What is a calcium score? Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure, no problem. So calcium score is essentially a way to see how much plaque you have in the coronary arteries. It's an imaging test. So what basically your primary care doctor sends you to is to sort of get a CAT scan. It's a non sort of very minimal radiation, almost like a chest X-ray, essentially, with no contrast, no nothing. You go into a CAT scan, the heart gets scanned in literally seconds. And what's nice about most plaque does have calcium in it, and you actually can see it on the CT. So this software essentially scans your heart and it gives you a score which basically correlates with how much plaque you have in the coronary arteries. Now, it doesn't tell you if the plaque is actually obstructing vessel. It just tells you how much plaque burden you have. Okay, why is this important? It's because the higher the plaque burden, the higher risk of if you're developing a heart attack, a stroke, or a cardiovascular event. And based on that number, we actually do change therapy. So just for example, a young person, this is actually what I use mostly clinically. Patient is 30, 40, 45, 50. His father died of a heart attack, at the age of 45, 50. And he comes to my office and says, Dr. Seguin, what can I do to prevent something happening to me similar to what my father did? So, we look at the patient's cholesterol. Maybe he's not, doesn't have high blood pressure. Maybe he doesn't have diabetes. Maybe he never smoked. Maybe he even exercises. And he does everything right. And he actually is even eating correctly. And then I'm like, well, I'm looking at him. Listen, you're doing everything correctly. Is there anything else we can do nowadays to really assess your risk? Well, that's what it is, the calcium score. So what the calcium score tells you is that, it tells you whether or not you have premature coronary artery disease, and which may warrant treatment much early on than we initially thought. And not only that, you can actually get the score and you can actually compare it to people, same gender or same age, you get a percentile. So you don't want to get a 90 on this or 95 like a regular test. You want to get a zero, okay? So the lower you are in the spectrum, obviously the better it is. And it really helps us clinically decide whether or not patients actually need to be on statins very early on in their life.
Well, it's very interesting because getting into the practicality of it, first of all, insurance doesn't pay for this test.
Correct.
And it costs $100. Like I said, I had it done. Bring your credit card. I mean, $100 when you talk about medical testing, I was amazed that it's a CT scan and you're only paying $100 for that and the interpretation.
Right.
Why doesn't insurance pay for this? Because people are getting it.
Yes, that's an interesting question. This supposedly was at least the initial thing that when it came out about 10, 15, even somebody more than 15 years ago now, it was quote unquote experimental. So every time that you wanted to get somebody's a calcium score, they always rejected it. We don't approve it as experimental. But over the last 10 to 15 years, we have so much evidence on this. Then I'm actually very, very surprised. Now, the thing is, again, any test you do can lead to more tests. Okay. And
sure.
I'm not sure if this is what the thoughts are of the insurance company or whatever. Is it costing more? But I hope, and I sincerely hope, that they realize that if we screen people for coronary arteries early on in their life, that's going to save a lot of healthcare dollars down the line. And I really have no explanation, but thankfully so. It's affordable to most people. $100 is not little, but I think it's a nice investment for the rest of you to see whether or not you are at risk of having a cardiovascular event. But hopefully, if anybody's listening from the insurance companies, maybe we can change their minds today.
Yeah, that would be pretty good, actually. Here's one of the things, and the reason I became more aware of the score, obviously I discussed it with my primary care physician, but I was with a group of other fellas, and everybody knows their score. I mean, they knew their calcium score, and, one fellow said, mine was, I don't know if it was 500 or 600, and his doctor right away put him on a statin medication to avoid further cardiac disease. He didn't need an angiogram or anything of that nature, but it seems like it's really helpful, and people love numbers. They love to know their score, their blood sugar score, their blood pressure score. So it seems like more and more people know their calcium score. I was happy. Mine was 73. But by the same token, you can get that number, but it depends on where it's distributed, right? So, I mean,
correct.
If it's all in one artery, that's a problem. So you do need correct. The imaging part of it, if I'm correct.
Right. So like I said, mostly, you know, this is actually reserved for people, like I said, actually want to know the number, just curious about the general health. But also, you know, to figure out whether or not they need medications early on in their lives, or even not, if they have symptoms for whatever reason, and they actually get all the tests done. Let's say they get a stress test, you know, they get an echocardiogram, and everything looks pretty normal, and maybe they still have some symptoms we're suspicious about, we do get that score, because if it's zero, there's very low likelihood that they have obstructive coronary artery disease with the, you know, there's blockage to one of the arteries. Now, you know, I can tell you, I've had people that have a score of 200 or 100 all the way up to 3,000 or even 5,000, okay? I mean, that's really, really high. And you'll be surprised. The problem with the calcium score is that, again, you don't know if it's in the vessel itself or outside the vessel. This particular patient that I had not too long ago, his calcium score was really through the roof. It's almost 3,000. But we actually end up doing an angiogram because he had some minimal symptoms we weren't quite sure about. And he actually had no disease that obstructed blood flow in the coronary arteries, which is wow. very, very surprising.
That's the kind of thing we like to hear about, and especially because it helps prevent problems. We're going to take a short break, and then we're going to be back with my guest, Dr. Ofer Segev. We've got a lot to talk about. I'm getting questions coming in now for him, so we're going to address those questions. And we're going to talk a lot about cardiomyopathy and further discussion of coronary artery disease. You're listening to Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080.
You got to know when to hold them.
We're back on Healthy Rounds. I'm your host, Dr. Anthony Alessi, and today I'm chatting with Dr. Ofer Segev. He is a cardiologist at the Hoffman Health and Vascular Institute. If you wish to reach Dr. Segev, the phone number 860-714-0187 if you wish to schedule an appointment with him. We had a question come in, and if you have questions and we can get to them, we're happy to do it live on the air at info@alessimd.com. Margaret just asked, Ofer, how does a calcium score compare to a D-dimer blood test? Can you chat about that a couple of minutes?
Sure. So a D-dimer is actually not something that's actually related necessarily to the heart. D-dimer is usually done when somebody comes to the emergency room, for example, with shortness of breath, and they want to make sure or find out whether or not there's a high likelihood that the patient actually has a clot in the lungs. So D-dimer itself is not actually something that we use necessarily to diagnose or heart disease or by any means, but it does have some implications on clotting in the body.
All right. Thank you for that question. Let's get right into coronary artery disease, since we've been talking about the calcium score. And we hear a lot, you know, it's Heart Health Month. It's also, we see on Fridays, emphasizing women's heart health. Can you talk a little bit about the sex differences in cardiac disease?
Sure. Tony, just to follow up on the previous conversation about the calcium score, I just want to mention one thing. So, you know, generally speaking, when the calcium score is a couple of hundred or even more, particularly into one artery, we generally do perform a stress test to make sure it's not obstructing blood flow. So I just want to put that in there. If somebody does have a calcium score of a couple of hundred, it's something that we really have to find out, even if they have no symptoms, actually.
So it's kind of a screening test to see, first of all, what do we need to do to make sure this person doesn't have a heart attack?
Right. Well, that's a loaded question, and we can talk about it a little bit later. But to answer your question about the differences between women and men, well, actually, men, you know, their presentation of a heart attack is usually a very typical presentation. They have the precordial chest pain. They come to the emergency room, you know, it's a radiation to the left arm and they have shortness of breath with most of the chest. Women, on the other hand, have very atypical presentations for a heart attack. They're tired. They're a little short of breath. So, you know, women do present differently. And sometimes, you know, to answer your question, first of all, there is something called stablecoin disease and a heart attack. This is totally different things. You can develop blockages in the coronary arteries over time not necessarily causing a heart attack. The heart attacks that we see in the emergency rooms are usually come from plaque or coronary plaque that actually does not obstruct blood flow. Let's say we find a blockage in one of the coronaries at 80%, that usually causes chest pain with exertion that goes away with rest. When people come to the emergency room and have a heart attack, usually when we actually end up doing an angiogram and looking at the arteries themselves, there's a lot of a thrombus in the artery. And when we actually, you know, suck the thrombus out, some of the time, there's actually absolutely no narrowing in the artery or very minimal narrowing in the artery. So that's the difference really between a heart attack and what's called stable coronary disease or plaque formation over years.
Okay, that's very important. That's very important distinction.
Yeah, and what we know is that this is why it's important, let's say, to do a calcium score, because if we know you have plaque in the coronary arteries, most cardiologists do prescribe a statin. Not necessarily to reduce the cholesterol, but reduce that dreadful event of a heart attack. Statins, we know, not only decrease the cholesterol, but also decrease the inflammation of the blood vessels, and that's what we think is leads to heart attacks and strokes.
Well, let's talk about ways we avoid it. We talked about some of the diagnostic ways, and we're always hearing about diet, exercise, rest, things such as that. Let's just take the diet, for example. There are so many different diets out there that we should watch. What do you recommend to patients who may be at risk? Say you have a family history, your lipids may be a little bit up. What do you recommend for that type of patient?
So I most of my patients, what I recommend is the Mediterranean diet. Okay, so it's pretty much rich in fruits and vegetables, fish, good fats like nuts and legumes like beans. All these are good fats and sort of, you know, the olive oils and all sorts reduce the inflammation in the blood vessels. But generally speaking, they're also relatively lean. And as you know, we're in a country where there's, you know, sort of an obesity epidemic. And even with minimal exercise and, you know, less calorie intake, you know, overall, if the balance is there, that by itself can reduce your weight, improve your blood pressure, improve your cholesterol profile, and eventually reduce the chance of having that dreadful event of a heart attack.
Well, you mentioned the word inflammation, which is one we hear about a lot. And we also hear about the use of aspirin, whether it be a baby aspirin, a full aspirin. When do you prescribe or suggest that people begin taking an aspirin for heart disease?
Okay, so again, a very loaded question. So we used to think
I'm good at those.
Yes, I can see that. That changes. That changes. It seems to change every couple of years. But essentially, you know, let's take the last year maybe off the table for a second. As far as I can remember, we generally recommend aspirin therapy for prevention of a heart attack and stroke for people. What increased risk if they have, let's say, diabetes, if they have hypertension, if they smoke, if they're, you know, over the age, let's say, of 45 for a man or 55 for a woman. That's what we used to think, that aspirin does have the benefit. Over the past year, though, maybe a year and a half, there came a large study about aspirin. And we actually found out that particularly as you get older, aspirin, the benefit of aspirin actually puts you in increased, let's say, bleeding rather than prevent a heart attack. So nowadays, and this is actually an important distinction, as far as patients who don't have any documented stroke or heart attack, we don't recommend aspirin at this time, unless, and this is my practice, and that can be varied between cardiology and cardiologist, unless your calcium score, let's say, is above a certain level. I use 100. I mean, there's some limited studies to show that there's some benefit of aspirin if your calcium score is over 100. But generally speaking, if I don't have that piece of information, I don't prescribe nowadays, at least don't start aspirin in people just blanket start of an aspirin. Now, if they've been on aspirin already, let's say for years, and they can tolerate it, and they want to continue it, I don't stop them from taking it, okay? But to start aspirin nowadays, we're a little bit more careful. Now, there's a big distinction because some people came to me who, let's say, have a heart attack or had a stent. Oh, yeah, I heard on the news I don't take aspirin anymore. You know, I'm like, no, 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 no. First of all, obviously, you want to talk to your doctor before you stop any medications. And not only that, those studies that you heard on news about aspirin, not taking aspirin, it doesn't really do anything, doesn't apply to people who already have the disease. And it's not just a heart attack or stroke. It's also peripheral vascular disease. That's, you know, blockages in the arteries of the legs or having carotid artery disease. You know, those people are just as high of a risk of developing a heart attack, even if you don't have documented coronary artery disease.
I want to move on. I have another question here, and this concerns cardiomyopathy. So a listener got in touch with me. They developed a viral cardiomyopathy post-COVID and actually were quite sick in the hospital with a declining ejection fraction. Now, eventually, with medication, they recovered. Now, this was a healthy young person who kept in shape, exercised regularly, and developed this cardiomyopathy. And so can you talk a little bit about cardiomyopathy in general, the post-viral cardiomyopathy? And I guess my question of how do you improve your ejection fraction? Are there things that you can do to improve cardiac output?
Okay,
a lot
well,
of questions in there.
Yes, okay, let's start with the definition of a cardiomyopathy, right? So cardiomyopathy is basically an abnormal heart function, okay? And there's two main reasons why you can have abnormal heart function. And we usually make a distinction in the initial diagnosis point. If somebody comes to my practice and we do an ultrasound of the heart, which is how we diagnose a cardiomyopathy, we look at the heart function with ultrasound, and we see an abnormal heart function, which is generally defined as an ejection fraction, another seven, less than, let's say, 50%. So an ejection fraction is basically with every beat of the heart, about 50% of the blood goes out of the heart. 50% remains of the heart. If it's less than that, it's sort of, we call it a cardiomyopathy. Now, there's two categories of a cardiomyopathy.
What do you consider normal for an ejection fraction?
An ejection fraction, usually we say between 55 and 65%.
Okay.
Anything below, if it's like 50 to 55%, we consider it a low normal. Anything less than 50 is considered abnormal. Okay. And that's based on prognosis data, like, you know, how long patients, if they have less than 50%, usually they have a higher risk of mortality. That's why we use those numbers. So again, just to explain what the initial point of diagnosis, we try to figure out, is this related to coronary artery disease or not? Okay. So, you know, if somebody has abnormal ejection fraction, generally speaking, we either do a coronary angiogram or we do a stress test to find out if they have coronary disease. If they don't, then there is a whole other differential diagnosis or possibilities that we go through to figure out why the patient has an abnormal heart function, one of which is what happened to your patient, viral, okay? Unfortunately, when we discover blockages, it's actually fairly easy to fix for the most part. If there is a scar in the heart or a patient already had a heart attack, as soon as you put on medications and let you open the blockages, there is a good chance that there's a significant improvement in the heart function. On the other hand, when, let's say, we found that there's no blockages and the heart, let's say, is very dilated for whatever reason, then the only thing we can do is medications. And we have plenty of medications nowadays to treat people with a cardiomyopathy. And a lot of them live a lot longer than they used to many, many years ago. Okay, those include anywhere from what's called beta blockers, metoprolol, or carvedilol, ACE inhibitors, which are pretty much all blood pressure medications, and slew of other ones that came recently on the market over the last 5 years. You know, patients' prognosis with cardiomyopathy has significantly improved the last 10 years, particularly with all the slew of medications we have. And I would say that more than half of the patients, if they're on proper treatment, do significantly improve the ejection fraction or the heart function over time with these medications, even if they don't have blockages.
At what point does someone need a heart transplant?
Well, that's people with the cardiomyopathy, okay, have various, the body has a way of sort of coping with it. Okay, some people have an ejection fraction of 5 or 10%, and sometimes feel literal no symptoms. Some people have a heart function, let's say, of 30, 35%, and it's severely symptomatic, okay? So a lot of it has to do with symptoms and their response to medications and their response to other advanced treatments for cardiomyopathy. Sometimes they something called LVADs, when, you know, people get implanted sort of a cardiac assist device to help them. So not necessarily a heart transplant per se, but a heart transplant is usually reserved for people who really are relatively younger, okay, relatively have no other conditions other than the heart itself being abnormal, because that's, you know, and obviously the availability of the organs is a key point here. But, you know, that's, you know, I'm actually not a heart failure transplant person, but we usually refer those once we put people on medications and they still feel really, really bad, then we move them on to the next specialist, particularly for heart failure, to see if they can either need a heart transplant or a ventricular assist device to help their symptoms.
Let's move on a little bit, because we're on the topic of ejection fraction. That's typically, you calculate that based on an echocardiogram, am I correct?
Correct.
Okay, so can you talk a little bit about what is an echocardiogram? And I know this is one of your areas of specialty in imaging the heart.
Right.
Can you talk a little bit about what someone should expect if they have an echocardiogram?
Right. So echocardiogram is actually, you know, essentially an ultrasound of the heart, just like babies get, you know, in the womb. It's a very simple, non-invasive examination of the heart where we take pictures in multiple views to look at several things. One, as you mentioned, is the heart function. Also looking at the cardiac valves. There's many conditions of the heart which involve the cardiac valves, and ultrasound or echocardiogram is excellent in diagnosing either a leaky valve or a narrowed valve, and also is helpful in looking in the pressures of the heart, because some people come to us and I get many patients that come to me not just necessarily for chest discomfort, which is could be a sign of coronary disease, but also with shortness of breath. And so echocardiography is very helpful in assessing the pressures inside the heart, either left and right of the heart, to see whether or not just increased pressures in the heart could lead to the patient's symptoms. So it's a comprehensive examination, not only of the heart itself, also of the aorta, which is the major vessel that comes out of the heart. Sometimes people with high blood pressure can develop an aortic aneurysm. That's something that needs to be followed over time. But it's become very comprehensive exam of the heart of the last. There's many new technologies looking at different types of parameters that have been studied over the last. But it's pretty much, if you get an echo and it's fairly normal, you can rest assured that you don't have any significant structural heart problem. Now, it doesn't mean you can't have coronary artery disease, but it certainly makes it more likely, particularly for you on the younger side.
Boy, you know, I got to tell you, I've got a whole list of things here we're not getting to. I guess I have to ask you this in wrapping things up. There are two questions. One is, what's the next big technology we should know about in respect to cardiac disease and cardiac evaluations?
Yeah, that's an interesting. Well, so things are getting developed all the time. So one of the things that we actually didn't talk about today is like valve replacement through non-surgical ways of actually replacing valves. I know we were going to talk a little bit about some other valvular conditions, but you know, over the last 10 years, we've been replacing valves through a catheter-based approach. Particularly the aortic valve. And I see in the future that we'll be able to do a lot more things, not with cardiac surgery, but through a minimally invasive approach, in replacing other valves in the heart through the same technology. That's what I see really what the future is that eventually we're going to see less and less and less cardiac conditions treated with surgery and more with minimally invasive procedures.
Ofer, it's been great having you on, and clearly we will have you back soon because there's a whole list of questions and more coming in on this topic. I want to thank you. Thank you for everything you do for our community. Thank you for setting up this new Hoffman Heart and Vascular Institute over there at Canton Crossing, those shops at Farmington Valley. Once again, to reach Dr. Sagiv, 860-714-0187 to set up an appointment and to gain access to his expertise. Ofer, thank you for your time today.
Your pleasure. Pleasure, Tony.
All right. We're going to take a short break, and then we're going to be back to wrap things up. You're listening to Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080. It was great having Dr. Sagiv. As I said, I didn't get to all the questions that we had. We had questions about heart murmurs, different cardiac anomalies that came up, and I did want to talk about valves, so we're going to get him back on. So if you do have more questions, I'll be happy to get them over to him directly. You can reach me at info@alessimd.com. And next week, we're going to be chatting about more and more. Somebody made me aware of a new treatment for multiple myeloma, a more common, we're seeing more and more types of this type of cancer, and there are some new treatments out there. So we're going to try and get somebody on to talk a little bit about that. And as always, you can get me questions. Many thanks to our studio producer. Kevin Kors has been on the board for us today. Jeff Chandler, as always, is in charge of sales and marketing for Healthy Rounds. And we'll always be taking your questions. If you missed any part of today or listening to Dr. Sagiv's interview, you can get that on the Healthy Rounds podcast. You can easily download that at Odyssey.com, Apple Podcasts, or really wherever you get your podcast, just search for Healthy Rounds podcast. Next up on WTIC is going to be Law Talk with Attorney John Matulis. I ask you to all keep in mind to stay healthy and keep in mind that this is an important month making sure that we are more aware of healthy hearts and keeping our hearts as healthy as possible through diet and exercise. With that, I wish you all a good week, and we'll chat again next week here on Healthy Rounds.
This has been Healthy Rounds with Dr. Anthony Alessi, sponsored by St. Francis Hospital, Rochford Eye Center, Hartford Healthcare, MD Advantage, and UConn Health Orthopedics and Sports Medicine. Be sure to tune in next Saturday morning at 11 for more Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080 and WTIC.com.